What is the crack? It's Gareth McGlynn here with your latest episode from the Pre-Construction Podcast. The crack today is all Irish. I am delighted to welcome Rachel Daly to the podcast. She is a cost and project management consultant in New York City. Now, Rachel, she's about 17 and a half years experience, and it all started back in her native Ireland in Limerick IT, where she studied quantity surveying. After that, she visited three continents. Now, within those continents, we had Ireland, obviously. She worked there for 4 or 5 years, then went to Australia and worked on the largest children's hospital in the Southern Hemisphere. She then left Australia for New York City. When she got to New York City, she secured a role with Linesight and spent 5 years on the JP Morgan Chase Tower, of course, their headquarters buildings. She's an incredible lady. One thing you do not ask Rachel is, have you got the numbers? Rachel is all about the numbers, and it comes from her upbringing, her culture, her education, and how she was trained and mentored in Ireland and Australia. And it comes back to that quantity surveying background. If you don't have the numbers, you don't have the data, you can get beat up in a meeting. And she always has her numbers right. She never gets asked for her numbers, because guess what? Her numbers are always right. What a lady. She's no nonsense, no bullshit. She gets to the point. Enjoy this one, because it's an absolute cracker.
Hi, I'm Steve DeLordo, founder and CEO of Concentric, the first holistic platform for pre-construction. As a former executive officer of one of the largest general contractors in the U.S., I have experienced firsthand the challenges the industry is facing, particularly in pre-construction. Pre-construction is still a highly manual and fractured collection of processes. Essential information is kept in ad hoc, scattered spreadsheets and documents, which really limits the understanding and hides the full picture of a project for all those involved. Concentric is here to change that. Our 360-degree platform unites data, workflows, and people. With Concentric, you and your team can access real-time insights and data, assess and mitigate risk to ensure a successful project outcome, and most importantly, unlock the enormous capacity of your talent and your data. To learn more about Concentric and to book a demo, head to our website, concentric.com. That's spelled concentric.com. Concentric, it's pre-construction recalibrated for the modern builder.
Hey folks, just a quick reminder about Advancing Pre-Construction 2023. It's happening in Phoenix, Arizona. It's happening on May 24th to May 26th. Now, if you're interested in going, it's the biggest and largest gathering of pre-con and estimating professionals. I'll be there, and a lot of my guests will be there as well. If you're thinking about going, get over to the website, simply Google Advancing Pre-Construction. During the checkout, simply put in podcast 10 to get a 10% discount. There's also early registration discounts as well. Rachel Daly, what's the crack?
How are you getting on, Gareth? What's
Not
new?
Too bad. Rachel Daly, cost and project management consultant in New York City. Thank you for coming on the Pre-Construction Podcast.
Not a bother. Been a dream of mine to always meet and greet you, Gareth. So here's a tick in the box.
Good. Brilliant. Well, listen, we've got a lot to get through. Over 17 years experience, but not only 17 years experience across three continents. So I can't wait to get my teeth into this. Obviously, everybody will have heard the Irish accent. So we will have subtitles on this podcast, especially on YouTube. So if you're struggling, jump onto YouTube and read along. So let's get on to it. So again, Rachel, from Ireland, studied in Limerick, studied a Bachelor of Science, Construction Economics with Quantity Surveying. Let's start there before we get into the travel aspect. How was that? And were you always destined for the construction industry?
Yeah, I suppose I was destined for the construction industry. I grew up around like five uncles. So I grew up in a yard, you know, they all had motorbikes and cars, and I suppose my youngest uncle, there's only 10 years between me and him. And I suppose he introduced me to Lego. For a girl, I was always a tomboy, and I always had a hammer, and I always had a screwdriver, and I was always the one that took everything apart, and, you know, would be watching TV shows from a small age, you know, no interest in cartoons, just interested in, you know, reading magazines that had a building or a structure. I'd read even the Lego magazines from front to back, you know. So I suppose it's down to my mum who introduced me to the first box of Lego at six. She told me one Christmas, I said, you know, the Christmas adverts came on and I said, I want that. And she was like, Jesus, how am I going to afford to buy that? It was actually a Lego hospital. But I'd say Christmas morning was probably over by 9 o'clock because I had it built and broke up and put back together. But I'm sure it broke her. But yeah, that's what probably got me into it, Garrett. You know, I just probably have a creative mind. I like bricks and blocks and I like walking around and looking at architecture and stuff like that. So I don't know. Is it a genetic buildup? I don't know. But I've always had a flair for construction.
Brilliant.
Whether it be put a screw in the wall, because, you know, I got a drill it for my 18th birthday too. I don't mind saying that out loud as a girl. But yeah, I suppose I always just had a creative flair for it. I did woodwork in school. I did construction for the Leaving Cert. Yeah, I don't know a time where I probably never was interested in it, so I probably can't answer the question, but I hope I did answer.
Oh, you did. You were destined for it from an early age. Yeah. And then obviously everyone's going through high school. You had your mind made up, which is brilliant. I mean, to be honest with me, not like me. I mean, I went through college and even university not knowing what I wanted to do. I was doing an engineering degree where I was like, I'll get this done and then I'll look at it afterwards. It was kind of time constraints. But you had your mind made up, which is brilliant. So through university, but even before that, through secondary school, was it always quantity surveying or had you other options?
I actually wanted to be, would you believe, an electrician, because one of the girls in school, she went through and she's like, electrician, she's like, I love blowing up things, you know, fixing things, putting a screw on a cable, what's the earth, what's the live, what's the neutral. I suppose I had a flair for it then too. And then I did woodwork. I always was like, right, how does this fit into this? How would this screw fit into this ball? Or I don't know, I just had that creativity. I did home economics, you know, cooking and all that, you know, I did it, but I didn't like it. And I used to get excited, I suppose, going down to the 2 hours of woodwork class on a Wednesday afternoon. Maybe it was the excitement of finishing it off and half the week was done. But I just loved going down there, you know, the smell of wood. It was at the far end of the school and you'd walk in there and then, you know, then I wanted to do construction, you know, and I went in and I did construction for the Leaving Cert. I actually built a cavity wall with a suspended timber floor. It was only four girls in the class. But, you know, we had a teacher, I suppose, that pushed us. And he said, you know, if any of the boys cross the girls, because I went to a mixed school, you know, and it was the boys that was helping us mix the cement and stuff. So I suppose when you're pushed in that direction back then, you know, people say, oh, times are changing. You know, women are getting more involved in construction. I think even back then, I suppose the school I went to, because it was mixed, the boys were involved in helping the girls. I don't know, maybe they were just had a good upbringing. But, you know, we kind of all struggled along together and built those walls. You know, I probably built a wall and the lad beside me only drew the wall. But, you know, I had the excitement back then of, you know, getting in and getting it done, I suppose.
Yeah, and again, it comes from your upbringing as well. I mean, I was the same. I was brought up on a farm in Donegal. Like, you either muck in or you don't eat dinner. As simple as that.
Yeah, yeah. I remember there was a stud wall in my house once upon a time, and it was, you know, the fridge was behind. I grew up in a council house. I don't mind saying it, and the fridge was. It annoyed me for years, and my mother came home one evening, and the stud wall was gone, and she walked in. I'm not going to ask, where's the wall gone? And she goes, more to the point, where's the electric cable that was going through the wall? And I said, I'm after pinning it up over there. You know, it's just a stud wall. It had six or eight screws in it. I just took it apart. It was annoying me. It was a hindrance to the room.
Yeah.
And since then, we've never put the stud wall back. It is what it is. People wouldn't believe it. I like that. Yeah, I was like, lads, it's just a stud. It literally is just a few screws and a piece of timber, a bit of skirting board. But some lads would be going, I don't know what she's on about. Because I suppose some lads just have a flair for different things, whereas I've always had, I'm mechanically minded. Maybe I'm just devil may work for idle hands. I don't know.
Yeah. I tell you what, Rachel, I would love to see a site of yours. If you arrived down and a project manager just decided to take a stud wall down and pin up all that, you would go bananas.
I probably would. I'd be like, where's the site? What's going on? Show me your paperwork. What's the piece of paper? Where's your watch? Yeah, imagine. Yeah. I'm very, very rules and very rule oriented, I suppose. But
we're going to get into that, Hitler.
If he's happy doing it, yeah, sure, he's happy doing it, yeah.
Exactly.
So
that's amazing. I mean, that sort of secondary school, being able to get in there, stuck in with the boys. Now, quantity surveying, I talk about this all the time in the podcast. I mean, the US system is not set up. The education system is not set up to supply the industry for QSs. So Ireland is, Australia, South Africa, UK, it's brilliant. It supplies QSs, and QSs kind of control the project more than anyone. What was the degree like? It says here construction economics with quantity surveying. Give for the US listeners that have never gone through a QS degree or haven't got a clue what it is, kind of break it down into what it entails.
So I suppose the first aspect of it is dollars. So maths, mathematics is a big thing of it. I had 4 years of maths, I suppose, mathematics that you'll never use because essentially you're always going to need a calculator by your side. That kind of interlinks then, you know, with mechanicals, MEP, you know, electrical scope. So you'd have a lot of building systems. How much mechanical ductwork do we need? So one thing leads into the other. Then you've got the building systems. Then you've got construction. How do we pour concrete? How do we lay blocks? What do we need in the concrete? You know, how do we put a roof on? Then you'd have your economics class, which was, you know, the world that we now live in. Stats, structure, stocks, cost, construction, stakeholders, CEOs, you know, that type of stuff that didn't interest me maybe back in the day, but I probably should have listened in those classes because it's very beneficial in this great nation of the States. And then, you know, you do a bit of estimating. They throw a bit of estimating in. We had an outside guy from a well-known firm in Ireland that used to come in and teach us, this is how many screws you need to go into the wall. You know, different things that, you know, that would have stuck in your head and you bring along with you throughout your career. I very much was focused on the construction part of it. Again, I had a serious flair for it, wanting to know how concrete's made, you know, the general basics of the 101s of how do you get into this. And I suppose I had a flair for how do you turn construction into money or vice versa? How do you build a house? How long will that take? You know, you need to know how much labor is involved. I suppose then there's a bit of flair now. And I think that the colleges back home have updated, you know, you've got land surveying. You can have the lads out in the field that are, you know, gauging the heights of the grounds before they, you know, go out and get the lorry to dig a hole. It was very interesting 4 year course. And then the sandwich year was the third year where I suppose I got my real, you know, feet on the ground when I went out and worked for a local builder. A lot of it was going out and checking stock. A lot of it was even going down to, you have to go out and play the block layer, go out and count these blocks. I remember the first day looking at the guy going, go out and count these blocks. He's like, yeah, you're 19 years old, off you go, night count blocks. I went to the site and I said to your man, I'm here to count blocks. And he goes, oh yeah, come on up here. And I was like, somebody's taking the mick out of me right now. Because you have to understand how many blocks are in a square foot, is in a square meter, how much cement he's going to need. Did he pour too many? How many bags did he order? It's what I know now to be the basics of construction, but college will probably teach you that, but it won't teach you that. It'll teach you the basics, but you also need to have, I suppose, the right head on your shoulder, a sponge for a brain, you know, because when you go out into the real world, that's where you do learn things. You get the general basics in the 4 years of college. I think you understand how to work then with a group environment, so you do all that stuff. Interesting course. I know they probably do it slightly different now, and it's probably more construction driven and, you know, estimating driven, technology driven, even. Like, we were still using floppy disks when I was handing in my coursework, whereas now everything is, you know, drop this box, you know, secret PDFs, you know, we had to print it out and hand it to the lecturer. So I suppose times have changed that way, but I suppose you're still producing the same work. But yeah, I suppose the 4 years of college were quite interesting. I got to know, you know, the best of friends that I still have to this day. Got to interact with 80 fellas and 4 girls, so you kind of get the blend to what it's going to be like in the male-dominated environment. But it's all part and parcel. And when you look back on it now, you go, yeah, that's what set me up for life. You know, you don't know it then as 19, 20-year-olds that those 4 years of technology are going to enhance your career a different direction. Or, you know, when you're doing QS and, you know, it's so wide, as we discussed, you know, it's so, you can become a specialist out of QS. And you can go down a different road. Go down any road, you know, you might get into one sector of QS and never touch another sector of QS. But I suppose I've been fortunate enough, I've touched every sector to maybe my own detriment. I've had exposure when it comes to you're starting on the project now and you're going to see to the very end. So,
yeah, brilliant.
Yeah, QS USN is exciting. Yeah.
That's a satisfaction part of it. I mean, we always hear pre-construction estimating. The big misconception is, oh, I never actually build them, never see it out to the end. But you do if you're with the right firm. But I love that, the whole practical side of it, the placement year. That's what kind of the penny drops whenever you think. I went through it as well. You think, you know what? And it's the internships in the US. This is for me. This is what I want to be doing. Because until you actually go out on site and count the blocks and mix the concrete and whatever it may be, then you don't you're still a wee bit unsure if this is for me or not. That's brilliant. And then after that, bit of experience in Ireland, the trip to Oz, how did that come about? And was that always, were you always kind of had that kind of itch to travel?
No, anyone that knows me would say I'm a complete home bird. I even go to Ireland probably 6 times a year. I usually make it home to Ireland, Garrett. Believe you me.
Oh, my God.
I'm a serious home bird. I suppose my mom always said I'm really for the immigration market. I think she probably regrets that now because there's no one at home. But, I never wanted to leave, and I never thought I'd see a recession in my lifetime. I never thought, you know, I always said, right, I'll get a grand job. I'll be close to home. I'll get a job in Limerick or Dublin. You know, I can move up there. I'll have the car. I'll get the house. But I suppose, again, life trying a recession in the majority of the, you know, 2010 big recession. You come out of college, you have 2 years experience. Then you're told, now we've no job for you. Sorry. You apply to every other firm going, from Roadbridge to big developers in Ireland who are still going, Sisk and John Paul and all those big ones. And you're one of 1,000 QSs that from all ages, you know, you've got people that are fresh out of college. You've got people with 30, 40 years experience that have just hit a GFC, and you're going, Jesus, you know, and then.
But hey, weren't you lucky? Weren't you lucky, Rachel, that you weren't 50 or 55 when that
100%. Yeah. And I actually met some of those boys who would have trained me up on site who were 50 and said, right, I'm leaving the wife and kids at home. I'm off to Dubai now because I have a mortgage to pay for. So I have. And I've met them since. I actually met two of the boys I was traveling back to Ireland once upon a time from Oz, one of the many trips I did. And I met one of them. He was a procurement manager back in the day for the company that I got my development experience with. And I said, are you still traveling back and forth? And he goes, I am. I'm trying to keep, you know, trying to keep two worlds afloat, the Irish family. And then, you know, living in Middle East, which was obviously a great experience for him. But like that too, he was 50 and still had 15 years before he was retiring. So putting up a
brave face. I mean, that's the choice. Like, it's okay to do that whenever you've got the choice to do that, but having to do that when you want to stay at home and have kids and miss your kids. I mean, I can't imagine being away from my kids. I mean, I'm not 50 yet, but I mean, that must have been tight for a lot of people. And even, I know you're talking about Middle East, and a lot of them had to go to London and Birmingham, Manchester, Glasgow. It's still away Monday to Friday most times.
100%. Like, and it's still, you look at it, as you say, you're still away from what you would call your bed or your family or, you know, your car, even driving up the country road back into, there's a certain level of comfort at going home. And even like me, that's why I go home so often. It's like that break away from the rat race that is America, or the rat race that was Australia. But yeah, I think traveling was never on the cards. And look at me now. I haven't been home in 15 years. So
brilliant.
Yeah, I suppose I'm destined to be here, I suppose, at this stage.
So there you are. Did you get the job before you left for Brisbane, or did you?
Actually, no, I didn't. I went to Brisbane with what we know as the Aussie green card, which was a skilled migrant. You know, not a lot of people did that. A lot of people went to Australia and had, you know, temporary sponsorship. So I went to Australia in the height of the summer, lived it up for 3 months on a beach with, of course, fellow Irish people that I knew. And then January came and I said, you know what, lads, I think I'll get a job because I think the pocket money is now starting to run out. And first job I applied for is the first job I got, and I stuck with them for 7 years. And
brilliant.
It's a great 7 years. Yeah, great 7 years.
So give us an idea. Yeah. Give us an idea with those guys. I mean, I kind of know what they do, but give us, anybody doesn't know, what do they do? What kind of construction do they do? It was a QS firm. Where did they go? What sort of developers, clients did they deal with?
So I suppose, just to put a bit of context in, it was actually the largest privately owned QS firm in Australia at the time. Glenn Cork, great man, hit it up with the other three guys, because as you can tell, it's a long name. We just abbreviate it like every other QS firm. But yeah, he headed it up, and then I suppose set up offices in every city. Again, of course, I hit to Brisbane because I love the heat. So I was like, I'm not leaving this place. I'll have a summer all year round. But QS firm was small and intimate, and I suppose their target audience were a lot of government work, you know, a lot of private work. So I did serious amount of work on hospitals. I worked on the largest children's hospital in the Southern Hemisphere. Not that I worked on my own, but I worked with a team of people who got great experience. Worked with, you know, private Queensland Rail, roads. Then you work with the likes of, you did some pro bono work with, you know, children's hospices, unfortunately, but I did work with that. Did a lot of housing developments, did a lot of high rises. You know, I got major exposure and experience to Australia. You know, you walk in the Monday morning, you don't know what hit you. But I suppose the beauty about working in Australia is I had two great mentors and they would sit with you from Monday to Friday. They'd say, right, you're on the master plan. You're a junior QS. We're going to get you to a director on this project. You know, and projects in Australia do take time. You know, clients want to know their budget. They want to know the value engineering. They want to know, am I going to have change orders on this? Will the design change? I suppose that's government work. You know, everything is very square boxes. You know, that this is what we want. You know, we want you to give back money at the end of this. Well, that's the way I was taught to. You always give the client back some money. So I suppose that's major exposure in all of those projects. And I suppose the experience that I brought with me, you know, to the next project. And I taught a lot of people on the way too. You know, I had an intern. And then when I was a senior, I had a junior under me. Then when I was an associate, you know, I had a senior under me. Yeah, the same guys are probably still there holding the scale rulers and the pencils. So,
brilliant. Yeah, I mean, that's a serious 7 years, Rachel. That's brilliant. I mean, to be exposed to them large projects, and listen, we can all do big projects, but those large healthcare projects really do teach you. What was the biggest takeaway, especially from the hospital, the children's hospital? I mean, the largest in the Southern Hemisphere, that's something else. I mean, how long did it take? How long were they in pre-construction? What was the big takeaways?
Yeah, I suppose a lot of that too. And the guy who was on it, he was only a few years older than me, but really, really sharp as a tack. And I'd be saying, how is he the same age as me? And he's running the whole thing. But of course, I worked under him. The pre-con too, I suppose, Garrett, you know, you go for master planning and that's when it all starts. You know, you estimate what you know. You know, you bring your experience. How many operating theatres do we need in here? How many beds do we need? You know, it's almost like they have, the way they do it is they've got room data sheets. This is what is required in every room. We're not coming along when we're putting the key in the door and we're saying, oh, actually, no, now we need this. Now we need this. No, this is what it's like for every hospital room across Queensland, across New South Wales. You know, there was a guideline book per se, and we knew what had to go into each one of those rooms. So you kind of start building benchmarking off that. And, you know, a lot of it, I suppose, was a core and shell project. You know, you have to get the four walls up before you put the roof on, before you put the windows in, all that good stuff. So I suppose it was a lot of takeoff. It was a lot of, Jesus, shit, the drawings have changed now from what it was, master planning to schematic to concept. You know, a lot of drawings you get, you do bills of quantities. I ground my teeth on bills of quantities. I'm still harp on about bills of quantities, but bills of quantities was where the pre-con. You know, we brought it out. We gave it to five or six different tenders who were mad for the market. And I suppose that was our guideline. That was our safety net too, that was our level of pre-con that we had. But I suppose that hospital took years and years and years. They had to build like a baby one beside it before they built the next one, make sure that they had enough staff to cover that one. Then, you know, you kind of work with the developer, which was John Holland at the time. Probably giving away too many secrets, and I probably don't know enough about it too because I was so junior at the time, but I still like to say I was part of building such a great, you know, unfortunately it's a children's hospital, but it was such a great piece of kit at the time, and you know, it's still going strong, and major infrastructure around it, you know, built cities around it, which is, I suppose, what Australia is. They build their infrastructure and then everybody goes there.
Yeah, they're brilliant. They're really, really good. Yeah. It was the same in Perth, but I have to say, I mean, you can say that the and we'll see it throughout your career. I mean, you seem to land on big projects, and it just doesn't seem to faze you at all. I mean, anybody else would be looking at that going, and let's be honest, you're saying that the guy was 2 years older than you, but between the two of you, managed to get through that and learn and deliver. So amazing. What was the biggest takeaway? What do you think was the biggest lesson learned, even during the early days as a junior QS?
I think always dot your I's and cross your T's is my biggest thing. And I suppose I bring it with me these days. I always, I'm kind of a battle axe in the office. I'm like, make sure that's aligned and make sure that's in, you know, it's quantity over quality. And sometimes actually I'll change my mind. It's quality over quantity. The biggest takeaways was just always have your numbers, know your numbers. Don't go in there and go, I'll come back to you with the answer. you know, whatever you present a client is kind of numbers you should back, you know.
Yeah.
That's, I suppose, what the guys that I sat around me to show me how, what side of the scale ruler to hold. That's what they taught me. They're always like, back your numbers.
Yeah.
You know, if you've got it done, back your numbers. If you've forgotten to measure a window, tell them you forgot to measure a window, but you know, you won't do that a second time, you know. So I suppose a lot of construction projects is lesson learned, and what can we build to what can we bring to the table the next time round?
Yeah. Every meeting's a battlefield, you know, when it, unless you have the data,
yeah,
you're gonna get eaten alive. But that's,
yeah, 100%, yeah.
And then, so I mean, obviously went there, stayed 7 years. Why the US? For a woman doesn't like to travel or doesn't like to leave home. Was it a case like me when I moved from Perth to the US? I wanted to get closer to home, but I didn't want to go home just yet.
You hit the nail on the head. Sure, it's only 5 hours sure from here to back home. I also have a sister who lives in the States, and I kind of had to twist her arm first because she's been here a long, long time. She's much younger than me, but she's been here longer. You know, she calls America home, whereas I probably still don't call America home. You know, I kind of had to say to her, oh, I'm only coming for 6 months, knowing damn well I was coming for long as I could, you know, pay the mortgage.
Yeah.
I suppose I got approached maybe 9 months before I ever had the 7 year itch. You know, and I said, no, Australia's for me. I love sun, sea, sand, you know, working Monday to Friday, 9 to 5. They followed me again, I suppose, chased it down, because I suppose that business at the time in America was starting to grow and grow and grow. And I suppose they just needed bums on seats, essentially.
Yeah.
So I suppose then I said, you know what, maybe I will. You know, it's again, the higher power is saying, right, Rich, go and just put this on your CV. Everyone says, you know, put another continent on your CV. I'm not sure whether that's benefited me today, but, you know, I said, look, another continent, I'm closer to home. And if it doesn't work out in 6 months' time, sure, I will go home. You know, the economy back home is picking up. I don't mind going back home to the smaller projects of building houses. Sure, yeah. Do that in my sleep.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so it was a free shot for you, you know.
Yeah.
And give us an idea. We do have some Aussie listeners on the podcast. Give us an idea of the process coming from Australia. And I think you're a citizen in Australia, so you got the Australian passport. Did you go through the Australian passport? How long did it take? Was it a quick process? Was it a long process? What were the stumbling blocks?
I suppose I got my Aussie passport after 4 years of being in Oz. You know, I had done my time, as you would say, and I got a letter in the post to say you're now eligible for citizenship. And I was like, for grand, $120, I'll have a passport in my hand, I'll go to a ceremony. All my friend Aussie friends will be there to cheer me on, and sure. They always say a second passport is very powerful, even though the Irish passport is quite powerful, as we know anyway. But I suppose the visa thing is easy. You know, I had the two options. I could have got an E2 visa or an E3 visa, which is what I'm on. So obviously the E2 visa is a five-year visa for what standard expats, English, Irish, South Africans all get once they've got an Irish or a European passport. But it was actually a much, much faster process for the Aussies. So I was looking across the room to the guy that I was dealing with, the recruiter, and I said, sure, which one is faster? He said, if you give me your Aussie passport, I'll give you a visa in 24 hours. You'll be up in the immigration in Dublin. You'll have to answer a few questions and you'll have it, and your passport will be back in the following few days. Now, that probably went a bit too fast for the likes of me, who likes to know everything. How do I get from rule A to Z without breaking J, H, I? You know, I'm very, as we've established, very much, I like to do everything. By the book, code of conduct, all that good stuff.
Yeah.
And I went to Dublin, had my interview. They probably looked at me a bit dodgy because I have this lovely Irish accent, and then I hand in an Aussie passport and I don't look Australian, you know. You know, I have to try explain, I actually have an Irish degree, but here's my passport. I spent more time in Australia than I have in Ireland with a qualification that I got in Ireland. Bit of a, you know, I had all the answers to all the questions. Again, I was probably, I'm a very new person to that process, Irish with an Aussie passport.
Yeah.
But then every 2 years, you just have to go home and renew it, or you have to go to an embassy that's an Australian embassy. So it's an easy
good.
Fix.
That's and good you can to go, know.
Yeah. Very, so very easy process. Yeah.
I did the other way too. Now it's a little bit more complicated and it takes a little bit more time, but that sounds a lot better. So that gives either Irish people in Australia the chance to either, if they're thinking about America, go and get your Aussie passport and it'll be much easier, or you can go down the E2.
And there's obviously quotas for select countries, and I got my visa in January, and I think there's 10,000 quotas based on treaty deals that the US and Australia have had, and I don't think they've ever achieved the 10,000, which is such a small number. compared to the 20 million Aussies that are out there. You know, such a small number. I think I was visa number 9 that year, the girl had told me. But, you know, I would highly recommend the Aussies. The small expat group of Aussies here, and I do know some of them, even though I'm not a fully, I don't sound Aussie, I just have the passport. But, you know, I've met some great Aussies here who are fellow QSs too. So, yeah, if you're looking for that jump and it's just a trial for the 2 years, I would highly recommend it.
Brilliant. That's good to know. Well, thank you for that. So obviously you've landed in New York. You've got the job with Linesight. You come to New York. Now, we all know within the US, we've talked about it before, QS is different. Construction's different. It's driven differently. The numbers are done differently. The control, the risk, the data, it's held in different places between the client, the architect, the contractor. How was it at the beginning? How was it to get your head around? Now, bear in mind, Linesight are obviously a QS firm, so your job probably doesn't change that much. But what did you think of the way things are done in the US?
I think the first 6 months, Garrett, were such a struggle for me. Not that a struggle, it's like I want to know everything and I want to know it now. I'm like, why doesn't this work? And, you know, you almost go to a new country and you start shouting and roaring and going, why isn't it done this way? You know, it should be done this way. And why aren't we doing it this way? And why are we going around the roads that, you know, these American lads want? And they're just brokers. And I suppose I'd run a few Fs and all that stuff out of there.
I would say you again, ruffled some fellas.
Again, that's me. Anyway, look, I'm very tongue-in-cheek and I kind of want myself to be heard. I know when to pull back. Sometimes not, but I know when to pull back. But it is, I remember someone saying to me the first day, oh, here's a bunch of change orders. And I kind of looked and went, change orders? What are change orders? Which what we know now are variations.
Yeah.
You know, you learn all the terminology is very different here. And even now I'm working with two junior QSs, as I call them, and I'm trying to teach them the terminology. So I actually did develop what's called in Australia, what the verbiage here, you know, it's just so they understand, you know, simple little things like, you know, obviously the measuring system is here is very different. I had to reteach myself how many square meters to square feet, inches from centimeters. You know, I remember when I left Australia, one of the lads gave me an imperial scale ruler. And I was like, what is this? He was like, you're going to need this for all them inches out there. So I, you know, I took that on the head. Right on. I'd say I used it once. It's gathering dust now in the drawer. But yeah, I suppose, you know, over here, it's very much, you know, rough order magnitude. Someone has given you the cost. You kind of have to feed back into that. Very little estimating, which I suppose is my flip passion. I love estimating. I love knowing the numbers on the page. I love knowing quantities. It's in my degree, you know, in the title. Yeah, it's very different here, but not something that you can't, you know, blend in with. You know, it's very easy to integrate in with it when you've got a good team around you too. And, you know, everything hits the ground here running at a speed of knots, as you know. So you kind of, you don't have the time to sit there and go, ooh, we've got 10 days to assess that change order. No, if it's not done tonight, it's not going to be done ever. And, you know, the developers have the upper hand, you know.
I can imagine you hitting the ground in Australia and just literally running because everything's the same and it's construction's the same. But the US and anybody that we've interviewed that came from the UK, Ireland, South Africa, Australia to New York or the US, it takes time. And unless you've got a mentor, someone who's willing to put the time into you for that first, and I say 6 months, it's really a year before you get really comfortable and confident. So that's good that you were able to do that. And it probably helped that you were with Linesight. I mean, generally an Irish company that's in the US. So that probably helped a lot.
Yeah, we were all a bunch of late 20, early 30 year olds. You know, we were kind of, you know, all trying to grind our teeth on the same thing. We might have had a different client, either be retail, but we were all in this, what we know now to be corporate real estate. Again, a terminology I never would have known until I came here. You know, commercial, you know, real estate is huge here. It's all you know kind of in New York.
Yeah.
And of course, I got the opportunity then to go to, you know, there's 50 great states in this nation. So I got the opportunity to kind of go to different states for different projects and that work kind of still, you know, you're still a basic QS on those roles. So, and again, I was working with probably Irish guys on that too. So they were trying to implement QS and as the leading force on that project. You know, you're kind of going, oh, well, Rachel knows how to estimate. She knows how to, you know, pull a few numbers together. So you're almost selling that product to real estate brokers. Right. Who would just go, oh, the cost per square foot for this is X, Y, and Z. And you're going, how do you know that? That's not reality. You know, I always like, back to our earlier conversation, I like to know the numbers before I kind of go in, you know, that kind of a way. So I suppose that's probably a major difference here. You kind of have to, a lot of stuff is done on a piece of paper. You know, back of the fag packet, as people would say, you know, the numbers are just done and that's what we're presenting and that's what we're going with.
Yeah, conceptual schematic stuff is quite common, yeah. That's, we can say that are quite common, but it's hard to believe that some of the projects, and I think you're going to talk about one of the projects in particular, it's hard to believe that a project like that can be done in the back of a fag paper. I mean, surely there was more.
I'm laughing now because it's probably the best way to showcase a QS in America, the project that obviously I'm talking about. You know, the numbers were done probably over a steak dinner. Here's what we can build. We've got a couple of billion in our arse pockets.
Yeah.
This is what we can build. Let's knock it down and build it up again. And then unfortunately, you have to go for extra money and X, Y, and Z. But I suppose once you can tell your story and you can back into, again, the dollars, as I say, you know, that's half the battle. But again, I like to know, How much of this material do I need on the project? I'm very detail oriented, as you can probably tell from our conversation.
And Rachel, and we keep coming back to the same thing. I think that's what makes you so successful, not only in Australia but also in the US, because you are a numbers person. You want to have your ducks in a row. You want to have the data, the numbers there before going on to a client. I mean, and if a client's sitting there and they've got $2 billion in their back pocket and they're turning around going, I'm thinking about buying this or I'm thinking about building this. You can literally there and then, rather than saying, oh, I got to go away and like find out how much it's going to demolish that, you can sit there and go, right, well, it's going to cost you this in a ballpark.
Yeah.
And then the next question that they're going to ask is, well, can you break that down a wee bit and show me how?
Yeah.
And then you can quickly, and storytelling, yeah. We talk about this all the time on the podcast.
Yeah.
Irish people are very good at storytelling. And if you can't storytell or kind of draw and talk through or visualize a story to a client, it's very difficult for them to understand it.
Yeah, and I was even telling a fellow yesterday who's doing a cost report for me. I was like, why aren't you telling me the story? I need to know that number. And I remember saying to him, why are you typing in the number? Tell me how you got to the number. And I suppose I'm definitely a broken record. Anyone that's worked with me will say the exact same thing. Rachel wants to know where the numbers are coming from. Tell me how you got your cost per square foot. I know it's two numbers, but tell me how you got to it. And tell me how you got to a meters cubed. You put three numbers. You know, I'm very much, I suppose I'm just bringing to the table what all my old leaders told me how to do, you know.
Yeah.
I always, the lads that I'm working with, the younger generation who are only in their early 20s, who have never been a construction site. I was like, I used to have to bring my leader a piece of paper and a red pen. And I knew when he took the lid off that red pen that I was in trouble. Not in trouble, but I just knew. Right, there's something wrong here. And I suppose you live and you learn. And it's a great way to learn. I still bring, people laugh at me. There's a photocopier in the office. Like, the only person that uses that photocopier is Rachel. She's killing all the trees because I have to have a set of drawings. I have to have my colouring pencils. I'm very traditional. And it's very hard to let go of that tradition. I'm still very much the quantity surveyor that, you know, I probably don't tell people I'm a cost manager. I still tell people I'm a quantity surveyor.
Yeah. Now, quickly, can we talk about this project?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, fairly. Yeah.
So the project that Rachel and I are referring to is JP Morgan Chase Tower HQ. I think it was started 2020. Is that right?
It probably started well before that, back to the numbers on a page, Garrett. Probably well before that, probably 5 years before that, you know, they just probably had a budget in their head and they said, we do need a new tower. You know, we're gathering more people. We're becoming, you know, one of the biggest banks in the world. We've got 10,000 people in New York. You know, we need to put them into one place and have one great tower and, you know, one great piece of architecture, should you say, on Park Ave. But yeah, so I suppose that started in, I started the estimates in 2019, one of the lead estimators in line sight. And yeah, it was just, how much can we build this for and how do we build this for? And I suppose it was released on a set of schematic drawings, much to my disappointment. It was just lines on a page and it was X amount of floors and no two steel members were the same, no bolts were the same. You had to bring in all your labor. It was probably 6 months of measuring. I don't think I looked at anything for 6 months. And you know, when you walked into the office, there was just drawings everywhere. It was very exciting. It's very unique. You know, everyone sees it now on LinkedIn and, you know, it's got great publicity right now. Everyone knows what it's going to look like. Hence why we're allowed to talk about it now. You know, we were sworn to secrecy for the first 2 years. Nobody knew what it looked like, you know. Yeah. We weren't allowed to talk about it, which is fine because I wasn't going to talk about it outside hours anyway.
Yeah.
It was a very exciting project. And then you see all the different trading floors, the executive floors, the top of house where, you know, they throw what they don't call parties, but that's what happens up there, you know, where all the decisions are made. It overlooks, you know, Vanderbilt, MetLife, all those other great pieces of architecture that are in Manhattan.
Beautiful.
Yes, it's a beautiful piece of work, to be honest.
So in your experience, and I know you've done large projects like this before, but what was the big takeaway from it? I mean, 68 floors, you mentioned there, it must have been 4 or 5 floors of MEP. What was the most exciting thing for you?
I suppose seeing it going together, the first node that went into the ground, I think one of the nodes is 60 ton. Like, people don't understand that when it's just a block on a piece of paper, and you've got to try talk to a contractor and get it best value for money for that. Then you see, I suppose, Jesus, there's the first floor going up. That's exactly what it looked like. Then they start lifting trusses onto site. Then they start putting in, right, lads, we're going to start putting walls into this place. And you're going, Jesus, you know, like, have we measured all this? You know, I suppose they run at the speed of knots in great, great companies like that. You know, they're onto the next leg of the journey. They're onto the next, right, what can we put into this floor? What can we change? I suppose the core and shell of it, which was the steel for the first 2 years, and it's going to go on for another 2 years, Ronnie, I suppose, a third of the way up. If you walk up Park Ave, you'll see that. Yeah, I suppose there's no great takeaways from it. It's just
logistically and schedule must have been an absolute nightmare when you think about a Park Ave and New York itself. I know Tishman have done this quite a few times now in their history. They're used to working in New York, yeah. But it must have been still for you to try and get the numbers right. It must have been difficult.
Yeah, I suppose I relied very much on this is what it is. This is how many tons are on each floor. And then I suppose we sold that to the stakeholders. Well, we know how much tons are on every floor. So when we get change orders, and don't get me wrong, I was getting $30 to $50 million worth of change orders on my desk every 6 to 8 weeks that we had to assess and negotiate, as well as, you know, an addendum drawn that came in, or a bulletin with, you know, the first few floors have completely changed. They've changed their minds about the interiors, you know, so you run at such a speed of knots that you're on core and shell 1 minute, and then you're on internals the next minute. And then the great thing about the tower too, I'm not sure whether you're aware, is there's live train tracks underneath it, you know, so I didn't actually work on that scope. One of the other QSs did, but, and at the same time, they're demolishing the existing tower behind it. So it's a great project to say that anyone has ever been on. It's a great piece of kit is what I'd say. It's phenomenal.
How did you know? We've had guys on here before, and gals, Chris Samarco, saying about certain projects that literally he nearly lost his life on, as in he lost loads of weight, stress, the headache of it. I mean, to be able to, and you're sitting there pretty comfortably saying as if it was another project. I mean, it is an amazing project, but when you think about the size of it, the cost of it, the train tracks underneath, there must have been times where you were going, is this actually going to work, or are we going to do this?
No, I don't think I ever doubt that, because you can never, look, I always say architects and engineers, their mess is going to be our success, because what they mess up on, I can go in and showcase my talents and go, actually, no, lads, maybe we can do it a bit better. You know, it's probably your time in the States as a QS to be able to voice your opinion and go, no, lads, that's how much it costs in another place, and this is how much it's costing here. You know, I wouldn't put my engineering hat on. Jesus, not a hope, but I'd be able to go in there and go, I think we need a different beam. But I think it's the whole value for money thing, and, you know, being able to compare it back to other projects and, you know, ring other consultants around the city and go, what did yours actually cost? You know, it's without giving away too much information. And again, I knew like that too. I knew how many pieces of steel they had to lift onto site, because I measured every piece of it. I knew, like, this lad's taking the mic. That's been built off site and he's bringing it on. You know, you kind of get a different flair. Again, it's all expertise and experience and going, no, actually, I looked at those drawings 6 weeks ago. That's not on that drawing. You know, it's almost just going, you know, you're in bed with the drawings. That's just the way it is. Like, you don't leave the drawings. There's a lot of late nights and stuff like that. And, you know, I had a great team under me, a great team above me. So, yeah, I suppose they just let me off. And, you know, as a QS, a lot of people couldn't have done what I did. You know, a lot of QSs have never been on building sites, which is sad to say. But I do know a lot of QSs who have never darkened a building site.
Shocking, Rachel, shocking. And never mind QSs. I mean, everyone in construction, whether you're in BIM, VDC, pre-construction estimating, you should spend time. And listen, in fairness to a lot of the contractors out there, the general contractors out there, and even the developers, they're doing rotation programs now where you've got to go on site at some stage. Yeah. So I think the penny has dropped. They are kind of action in that part of it. But I would like to see them in the US, as they call it, in high school. They need to be introduced to construction back then, because we know now, even within QS and BIM, VDC, I mean, all of that, there's so much to do, there's so much opportunity. Now we've got technology coming into the fore. And you know what? Let's hit technology. You mentioned CostX, you're an advanced user, I saw on LinkedIn. Tell me how good CostX is and what you liked about it.
God, everything is so good about CostX. I preach about it all the time. I haven't used CostX probably in a year now, but CostX is so advanced. Like, you can go in and overlay the drawings. You can move the drawings. You know, CostX is just lines on a page. It's just the advanced scale ruler, essentially, is all it is. But you can apply rates to it. You can apply labor rates to it. You know, it's so advanced that you should be able to go in and overlay a drawing and should be able to spit out what the cost difference is. Now, we're not there yet. But with the implementation of BIM and VDC, as you say, and for lack of a better term, I know AI is also trying to slowly creep in there. I think in the next 10 years, these software platforms are going to be amazing. But CostX is one of a kind. Yeah. It's so fast. You know, you can use it remotely. Look, there's a cost associated with it. There's a cost associated with it because it's so good.
Yeah.
I used it for years and years and years, like, back on that tower that I was just on. Every single drawing for that tower is in one folder. Everything is overlaid. I knew where all the changes were. Again, I would gauge my eye. I probably wouldn't trust technology to a point, but you know, I could pick up what the guy beside me was measuring and maybe give him or her, you know, a push in the right direction. You know, you can use it remotely. I could be on a plane using it. You know, it's very user friendly. Very easy to scale it up once the drawings are right, once they're wrong. It's very easy to use. And I probably didn't use it to the degree that I should have been using it. I probably was only using 20% of the 100% capabilities that it has.
Yeah. And what about, you mentioned BIM VDC. Did you go off BIM VDC on the tower a lot? Was that?
No, I didn't. I probably refused to use BIM to the point that it was only catching up with me and I was getting change orders and I was like, right, I'm not using BIM if I'm getting change orders already. Well, they weren't change orders. Let's just call them bulletins or addendums. I would have said they're change orders because I already get my budgets created. But I used actually BIM quite a lot on a tower in Australia on 1 William Street, and BIM was great for reinforcement. Good. Again, I'd measured all the reinforcement by hands, the connections,
of course,
and the link.
You did.
but it's just because, look, that's what I was paid. That was my job at the time. It essentially was the CostX, the manual CostX, should we say.
But
BIM is great. I think BIM has a great opportunity to evolve and, you know, put costs there. But I think there also needs to be a QS behind that that's putting in the costs and ringing the subbies, ringing the suppliers and getting the costs, getting today's rate. You know, the market the way it is at the moment, you know, it's a full-time job for 5 or 6 people in one office to keep up with those numbers at the moment.
Ah, it's bananas. It's bananas, Rachel. And that brings me on to my final point. Now, we're going to go through this with Rachel, because Rachel's actually put a piece out on LinkedIn. What I'm going to do as well, as we're talking about this, I'm going to grab the link to it, and I'm going to put it in the subject notes. So if anybody wants to read it in full, you can just click on the link. It's basically about the supply chain disruption. I mean, we all know about the inflation rates at the minute, 7.5%, the highest in 40 years. But the big thing for me is this supply chain kind of disruption. Give us a quick overview of that article and what your thoughts are and what we've seen over the last 12 months, 24 months, and what we can see in the next.
You mentioned there 40 years is probably, you know, it's peaks and troughs, Gareth. And I've actually done in the past 6 months, I've actually done a similar task, you know, just rough numbers on a page. It's every 40 years that this appears to be the highs and the lows. You know, we go back to 1980, we go back to 1940 when all the construction essentially took off. But I suppose escalation, inflation is a big thing in this world at the moment. And that leads to the supply chain. And I suppose the pandemic back in 2020, to probably still today, has had a major disruption, an effect on everything from the likes of cement, gyprock to nails. I suppose the biggest aspect for me was when I was on the tower, it was steel. You know, the, where are we going to get the steel from? You know, we have a program, we've got a schedule. This has to be turnkey by a certain date. How are we going to get it in? Is there enough iron ore in the world? You know, where are we going to get it from? Again, as a QS, that's not really my problem, but it almost became my problem because my costs were being affected. You know, what's this going to cost me if I don't have my correct supply chain or my supplier down the road to give me the materials to build this product? Right. You know, so that's I suppose a high overview of the supply chain issue that I saw back in 2020, 2021 when I kind of wrote that article.
Yeah. Are we seeing things flattening out now? I mean, I know everybody's kind of kicking off about switchgear.
Yeah, I think look, the price of living is probably a big thing. Salaries are increasing, you know, everything in the world has gone up. Even when I hear people back home and they say, oh God, the price of the euro has gone up. I'm going, Jesus, try living in the States and what we're living in and, you know, what you pay out. But I suppose it's ebbs and troughs. It's everything. Yeah, to me, it's flattening out because I think architects are starting to be more wiser now with their sustainability programs. There's the great leads platform is in America to listeners that probably don't understand that it's all about sustainability and green energy and all that good stuff. And where can you actually get it's almost like, can we buy this locally? Can we buy the gyprock locally? You know, it's, can we run down the road to the local hardware store? Yeah, you actually can. You know, the local hardware guy down the road might actually sell it to you for cheaper because you're trying to get rid of it. So again, it's back to the old QS and days where we had to ring the suppliers, the likes of the heat merchants, Heat and Buckley's, Chadwick's, all those guys back in Ireland and say, what's your best rate? We're building 12 houses. You know, it's back to all of that. And I think shop around is probably the main thing. But when you're on a tower and things like that, it's kind of hard to shop around when you've got one supplier. So, you know, you just got to take it as it comes. But I do see it flattening out. Cost per square foot is starting to level out. But I suppose if the cost per square foot is starting to increase, it is because of labor price increase and material shortage. And we can't fix that overnight, unfortunately.
No, absolutely not. No, there's no way we can do that. But thankfully, I mean, I don't know about you, but we've never been busier. So I'm pretty positive and bullish about 2023 and 2024. Well, listen, Rachel Daly, this has been an absolute pleasure. Now, the good news is this is not that, well, it is your first, but your second episode is going to quickly follow because we want to do, well, I want to chat to Rachel about what it's like for a woman in construction. It's a very, very important topic. Obviously, it was last week, but we want to talk about it in great depth. So we're going to release a second episode that's going to be coming out in the next 2 months. So definitely stay tuned with that. But for now, Rachel Daly, thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Garrett.
Stuck in spreadsheets? Tired of the endless loop of copying and pasting? Now imagine all your estimating workflows in one program. Beck Technology's innovative Destiny Estimator software streamlines the entire estimating process. With intuitive tools and powerful analytics, you can create accurate and reliable estimates quickly and easily. We understand the challenges pre-con teams face because we were born from construction. When you are ready to streamline your estimating effort, visit us at beck-technology.com and talk with a tech expert in a Destiny Estimator demo today.
Rachel Daly, the QS in US, it's question time. Right, first question. What's your favorite project that you've had in you've almost 17, 18 years of experience?
My favorite project is one of my first projects. It's at Caloundra Hospital in the Sunshine Coast back in Australia. It broke me. It uses many tears, many times I cried over it. It was only $6 million Aussie dollars when I think about it now. But I suppose I was on it from schematic to post contract to close out. But yeah, that thing killed me. There was asbestos and everything in it. So it's one of a kind, but I'll never forget it. I even know how many change orders to this day, some of the values of the change orders. Sad and all as it sounds, but yeah, that was the one I suppose that I felt, I've made it. I think I've made it now, lads.
Right. It just shows you, I mean, you've somehow had some unbelievable projects. I mean, we talked about it there now, JP Morgan Chase Tower, but it just, you never forget your first, do you?
No. And it was on the bill of quantities of that. Was it the bill of quantities for every project that was on in Australia? But yeah, no, it's the one that kind of stuck. You'd get up early in the morning, 6 o'clock morning, get a lift with the boss up. So you could go into one meeting, he could go into the other. You'd walk around, you'd say hello to all the nurses. Of course, that's the Irish in me saying hello to everyone. But yeah, it was one of the one of the projects, you know, that I was on, and I, you know, the same Hutchinson's Builders were the guys at the time, and I saw them, and I actually saw them on different projects in rural Australia since I did that project. But yeah, that was the one that probably broke me, but one that sticks in my head too. Yeah,
brilliant. So, biggest lesson learned in construction?
Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid to voice your opinion. Ask all the questions in the world. Sometimes the question that you have in your head might be the question the lad or the lady beside you has you, but they're too afraid to say it. So just always be afraid. Don't be afraid to put your hand up.
Love that advice. Next one. How do you de-stress? How do you get away from it? What is the technique or the hobby that you have?
I suppose I've learned through my career to do close the laptop, that it will be tomorrow's problem. I remember someone said to me one time, we were in a boardroom and I was probably only 25 or 26. And what did he say to me? I can't even think now. He goes, you're not saving lives. And of course, I turned around, being a smart arse little Irish one inside in the boardroom. I suppose I had a backing of my boss at the time. He was Scottish. And I turned around and said, no, but I'm saving money, aren't I? And so I suppose that was one of the key takeaways that I had from that. I wasn't being smart. I probably was taking money off his paycheck because, you know, we were one QS versus another. But yeah, I suppose that's one of those things.
The truth hurts. So favorite food?
Favorite food. Jesus, we're spoiled for choice here in the States, aren't we?
Yeah, especially New York.
I love Mexican food. I have to say, I love Mexican food. Yeah, I love just going to, even it sounds bad, but just going to the local corner, the lad on the corner there that's selling his tacos, and you know, they're probably the best. You can see it being made. It's easy done.
Yeah, ours is the same. We have the Green Rancho and the Hell's Kitchen. That's our Friday. Favorite sports team.
Oh God, no, I've given up sports a long time ago. I suppose I'm a New Yorker now, I suppose. I love the Yankees and I love the Jets and the Giants. But I suppose when I was in Australia, I followed the Brizzy Lions, and I actually still follow them because there's a lot of Irish guys on those teams. So TG Carter at the time used to, when I went home on vacation, actually used to, you know, you'd be staying up in the middle of the night and they used to play it. They used to watch it all. I go to the basketball. I'm actually going to the hockey on Monday night. So I'll go to any sport that's on in Madison Square Garden. So, yeah.
Brilliant. Now, let's have a shout out. We know how important mentors are. We talked about it in the main feature there. Who has been the biggest influence in your career?
Biggest influence. Definitely a man, obviously, because it's the environment I've picked. I'd say everyone in Australia was my mentor. I wouldn't say I probably had a mentor in America, because I've probably been chip on my shoulder kind of attitude, but definitely in Australia, I've had every director I had kind of took me under their wing. You know, they kind of almost had a fancy to me. So I don't really want to name any of them, because they were all equally as good, no matter what age they were. You know, I had two great mentors who still almost make me choke up now. That showed me the reins, and they weren't even Australian; they were Scottish. So I'm sure if they listen to this, they'll know who they are. Yeah.
Good man. Well, shout out to the two Scots in Australia. Rachel Daly, thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Garrett. Superstar.
Well, folks, I think I need to take a breath. What did I tell you? Rachel Daly is a no-nonsense QS based in New York City. I love that conversation. And as she says, if you don't have your numbers right, it's very difficult to do anything. And if I was building a large high-rise in New York City, there's only one lady that I would want in my corner, and that's Rachel Daly. As you can see with her, she's pretty open. Listen, if you have any questions, I'll drop her LinkedIn profile in the show notes. Drop her a message, hit her up. She's more than happy to help people. I'll also put the link to that article that she wrote back in 2020 in relation to this disruption on the supply chain. Listen, folks, there's loads of more great episodes coming, so please stay tuned.